Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
So what we wanted to do was to be able to talk about what does democratic socialism mean to millions, hundreds of millions of Americans. And Bernie Sanders has done that.
That's the voice of economist Robin Hanel. This is segment 3 in our 4-part series on the economy, so stay tuned.
On our conversation about the economy, what is an economy? What is a productive economy? How do we create a participatory economy that engages people and inspires people with a vision of an inclusive, more just, and productive society? We talked about, you know, the beautiful example of Venezuela, you know, in the recent years of creating a participatory economy, an economy for the people, by the people, where you've highlighted that an economy that has populist redistribution can create beautiful possibilities where people can become engaged, and how the more participatory an economy is, the more people take ownership and responsibility for creating more of that. Can we talk a little bit about the barriers, the challenges we face, and what are some of the obstacles that make it difficult for us to create that kind of productive share economy?
Well, I mean, I think Venezuela, again, let's stick with that as an excellent example and learning experience. I mean, the first obstacle they faced was the complete and total hostility from the U.S. government, which aided and abetted a very tiny percentage of the population, the wealthy plutocracy, in an attempt, a military coup attempt to overthrow this government, which was nationalizing multinational interests that were not serving the interests of Venezuelans. And that was using things like the oil revenue, you know, to provide benefits for the poor population. So that's the first thing. You do face worldwide, but particularly in Latin America, and particularly as close as Venezuela is, and as close as the United States' involvement in Venezuela has been. Exxon Oil Company basically built itself into a world power on the basis of its ownership of the oil fields in Venezuela. The reason Venezuela has great baseball players is that Venezuela was very much a U.S. colony, you know, during the first half of the 20th century. So that's the first obstacle, that you face the implacable opposition of the U.S. government, the most powerful government and military force on the planet, and you're in our backyard. And you have to be a complete and total fool not to be aware of the fact, you know, that the U.S. is looking for any opportunity to throw you out of power as you move in this direction. The more you move in the direction we're talking about, because you're asking, what are the obstacles to moving in the direction that we've been talking about? Well, the more you move in that direction, the more implacable the opposition and the more intense the opposition from the U.S. government is going to be. And that's not going to change with Hillary Clinton. So that's the first thing. The second thing is there is an internal opposition. They have engaged in the kind of politics the Republican Party is engaged in vis-a-vis Obama for the past 6 years, scorched earth. They will do anything they can to create situations where there's chaos, where there's no food that's available. They will go out of their way to go ahead and create the conditions whereby people will lose faith in this government that's trying to move in this direction. And the harder you try and move in this direction, the more implacable their opposition will be. And they still control most of the jobs and most of the production in Venezuela. At some point, you're going to have to deal with that. I'd say there's two other things. One is political. Have people really figured out, do we have sort of agreement about what are the steps that you take in order to build a participatory socialist, eco-socialist economy. Do we know how to do that? Is there agreement on how to do that? Do we have a plan in mind? Or are we kind of winging it and feeling our way as we go? Well, we were very much doing the latter. So there was a government that was trying to feel its way toward what is this new kind of 21st century socialism going to be like? And it didn't really have sort of plans and strategies well worked out, that it had agreement amongst its own cadre and its own thinkers and its own leaders. That's the third problem, the third obstacle you have to overcome. The fourth obstacle is the one I was referring to briefly when I said most people have been told all their lives, and this has been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years, you aren't smart enough and capable enough to make the important economic decisions that affect you. You just have to trust somebody smarter than you, somebody more clever than you, somebody better educated than you to go ahead and make those decisions. Or otherwise, the economy isn't going to work very well for you or anybody else. Has there ever been a time when human beings, since we lived in small clans where most economic activity was done through cultural institutions and it was self-directed activity, ever since we developed into societies that were class societies, class means a small number of people are ordering a large number of people. And we have been living in class economies and class societies for thousands of years. That is a tremendous inertia to overcome. It's a tremendous inertia to overcome. So those are the obstacles that need to be overcome in the case of Venezuela and in sort of general. And they're not easy. It's a very difficult path. I think it's important for all of us who see that as our goal in some broad sense to appreciate where it is that people have taken more steps and more successful steps along that path and have generated learning experiences for the rest of us. And that is my feeling about Venezuela. As sad as I am about the way things are going right now, I still have a tremendous respect and admiration for the fact that they have done more there than anybody has any place else to try and figure out how it is that we march on this difficult, difficult path to overcome these very difficult obstacles.
I agree with you that it's a strategy is very useful and is absolutely something we have to work towards. I would disagree that it's inevitable for us to make change without it, because we have seen that they did. What I would like to focus on perhaps maybe how do we hold on to the gains that were made, being fully and wide awake to the challenges we are facing, because the challenges are many, but also the gains we have made are very palpable and real, and they have made significant transformations in the lives of people, primarily the poorest in Venezuela and in some of the regions that were affected by the changes they made.
My own sense would be if I were there and if I were involved in those discussions, I would be pointing out, look, we always should have been moving from serve the people in the direction of with power for the people. We've had that slogan around for a long time, since the 1960s. You can go back to the Black Panther Party here in the United States. And there's a big difference between we are trying to serve ordinary people, particularly poor people in need, and we are trying to empower them to take what is theirs and do with it what they decide to do. We always knew we needed to be making that transition. Now we face a situation where oil revenues are down, where the economy is in rather bad shape. You know, export prices have fallen for things other than oil, where there's less and less medicines in the clinics, not more and more clinics with more and more medicines. So we're in a situation where we actually don't have as much to redistribute in order to sort of serve the interests of the masses of Venezuela. The only way to go forward is to basically empower them to take the power themselves. There's two ways to respond to the fact that there's less to redistribute. One is to cut back on redistribution and just hope that you can hang on to political power until things get better. And I think that's unfortunately one of the tendencies. The other reaction is, okay, there is less to redistribute. We never wanted to be about redistribution in the first place. We wanted to be about empowerment. So let's crank up the energy and the ideas and the strategy that has to do with empowering people in a situation where we actually can't increase the amount of redistribution we're doing at this point anyway. But it's not easy. These are things that are easier said than done.
Yeah.
Let me put it that way. There's a lot in life that's easier said than done.
Wouldn't you agree then that the solution seems to be both, you know, in different contexts, almost the same one, you know, increase the power, increase the access people have both to the political levers by means of education, political education, but also sharing of, you know, the resources that are essential to life, to engagement, to participation.
But in the particular case of Venezuela, not only do you need to be working on empowering those people who have received material benefits from redistribution over the past 15 years, you need to be taking the power out of the hands of your enemies. And as long as you leave the major part of the economy in the hands of the private employers who are implacably opposed to a continuation of this government, they want to go back to the way Venezuela was in 1955. They want to go back to when the oligarchy in Venezuela was literally ruling over 95% of the population, who were simply destitute masses. Now you've got a huge chunk of the population that is gonna, you know, would have a hard time stomaching that. So you need to empower them so that they can defend themselves, but you also need to take that economic power away from your political enemies. Instead of using oil revenues to make loans to start up small, you know, workers' co-ops, you actually, now that you have less rural revenues and you can do less of that, you need to actually go out and start taking over the businesses that have been deliberately sabotaging the economy, trying to get a political counter-revolution. You need to actually go out and start doing that. Now, why would you hesitate? Well, that's going to increase tension. That's going to further anger the opposition. That's going to further embolden the U.S. media and the State Department to say, oh my gosh, look what they're doing. They're expropriating private property in Venezuela. Yes, it's scary. On the other hand, if you don't move in that direction, where will it inevitably end? Right now, the trend is definitely in the wrong direction.
If you were appointed to President Maduro's council and you were to implement, you know, a recovery strategy, this very process of empowerment, what would be your top three recommendations as we moved into this period of unknown? Because, you know, we are making the road as we walk.
I would take the step which the Bolivarian Revolution has yet, I mean, what are we now, 15 years? And they have avoided any sort of large-scale nationalizations of the private sector. There have been some around the edges. There have been some that just sort of had to be done. That happens in countries that are not trying to build 21st century socialism. They really have done no more of that than countries, you know, that aren't trying to build 21st century socialism. They've put that off for a very long time. I can sympathize with why it was put off. It was put off because, first of all, it is provocative, and so you risk creating a political crisis. It was put off because I think they were incredibly honest. They said in the very beginning, well, what are we going to do if we tip over these private businesses? How will we organize people to run them? And the Cubans said, well, we'll show you how to do, you know, socialist planning Cuban style. And they said, but we don't think that works. That's not what we want. And I think they were right about that. So they were incredibly honest and said, part of the reason we're not going to take over private businesses are we have to learn and feel our way toward how to run them better. And so instead of just large-scale nationalization in the early years and having the Cubans come in and set up the Cuban planning system, instead of doing that, they very wisely started building the social economy slowly so they could figure out how do we want to run things. We don't want to take over anything that we don't know we can run better. But I think that they've had those years. They've done some of that. And at this point, they have to take that step. So I think they need to take over businesses that are being deliberately mismanaged in a way that is creating economic chaos inside Venezuela, all of which just discourages the population, discourages your supporters, and emboldens your enemies. I think they need to be much more aggressive about taking those over, and they need to go ahead and whatever they've learned about how you can run businesses non-capitalistically in these years with the social economy, they need to put it to good use and see how it goes.
So how do we take some of that responsibility, you know, of creating a social context where a beautiful revolution like the one that took place in Venezuela, and we call it a beautiful revolution because, you know, they didn't have to kill 50% of their people in order to liberate themselves and start dreaming of a socialist economy and start dreaming of a different way of connecting and creating that productive economy that serves all of the people, not just a few.
Sylvia, I'm very glad you said that. We need to step back and recognize what a momentous achievement it is to have moved as far as they have moved without having, you know, massive percentages of the population being killed in warfare. That's an incredible accomplishment, you know, that they should be proud of and that we should appreciate. You're Canadians and it's a little different, except you basically just are part of our foreign policy. That's your problem. Your problem is have your own foreign policy and don't just hitch your wagon to the U.S. That's what you need to fight for in Canada. In the United States, the first thing that people need to do is we need to work to try and prevent our government from being the one that stops the Venezuelans from doing what they're trying to do. And the second thing is that those of us who want to have more progressive economies and societies, we need to learn lessons from what they've been doing in Venezuela. They have been doing things that we can learn lessons from. This is how you do this. This is how it works. This is where you're going to run into problems. This is how you cope with it. They're decades ahead of us, and we can learn from their experience. It doesn't mean we have to sit here and say everything that their government says that we agree with, that that's the right way to do things. But we should recognize that they have accomplished so much more than we have. They're decades ahead of us on the road we'd like to be on. And we need to keep our government from stopping them. That's the primary things that people in the United States can do.
As we approach the U.S. election, what are your hopes in terms of our social movements here and the moment that calls us at this time?
Well, it looks like Trump is imploding. It looks like Hillary Clinton would have to do something incredibly stupid to blow this election. Having said that, I would also say this is a year where all of the polls and all of the expectations have proven to be wrong over and over again, that the anti-establishment sentiment in the U.S. political in U.S. politics right now and in European politics right now, the anti-establishment political sentiment has never been higher for 50 years. And that makes it very difficult to be very confident about predicting electoral outcomes. But I am hopeful that Clinton will win. I'm hopeful that she will win in a landslide, because as long as the Republicans control the House of Representatives, they will continue to engage in scorched earth policy. Anything that requires a law to be passed, you know, to change at the federal level. If Clinton is elected, but the Republicans continue to hold on to the House, it makes it very difficult for us to make any sort of progress in terms of national policy and changes in national laws. That includes spending, That includes health care. So that's my fear. My expectation is we'll have a Clinton in the White House and the Republicans will be further embittered and in scorched earth mode over in the House of Representatives. So we'll have divided government just as we've had divided government under Obama. Let's leave Trump and the anti-establishment sentiment on the right wing of U.S. politics aside. Something has happened in the U.S. political scene that has not happened here probably in 80 years. And that is the Bernie Sanders, our revolution, the Bernie Sanders candidacy through the Democratic primaries has essentially mobilized people who are of a progressive mind, who are disgusted not only with Republicans and Tea Partiers, but the Democratic Party establishment presiding over 30 years of neoliberal economic policy and 30 years of increasingly dysfunctional imperial wars and interventions. That has been mobilized to a greater extent, you know, than my lifetime. I have long believed that the U.S. left needs a multi-pronged strategy. We need to build social movements. We need to build experiments in equitable cooperation. And we need some sort of productive way to engage in electoral politics, not just locally, but at the national level. I believe that because the United States is a very politically immature society. U.S. citizens, on average, spend less time thinking about politics than citizens in any other country in the world that I have ever been in, and that includes very poor countries. In poor countries, people are much more politically savvy and sophisticated than they are in the United States. On top of that, the little attention that most Americans pay to politics is focused on the 6 months before a presidential election. So how can you be a serious political movement and have no successful way of engaging with people when they're paying attention to political issues? That's been our dilemma. And we've had that dilemma now for presidential election after presidential election. Do we do third party? Do we do the Greens? Do we run safe state or do we run strategy? How do we approach this? And we have a very difficult situation because we are a two-party duopoly. We don't have three or four parties. We don't have a parliamentary system. So it's very difficult to figure out how do you participate as progressive forces in the U.S. political presidential electoral season, which is the time when you can actually talk to most Americans about anything political. We haven't had an answer to that, and I think Bernie Sanders has given us the answer. You have to run progressive candidates in the Democratic primaries. And if you win and you have basically taken over the Democratic Party, fabulous. If you don't win in the general election, you do not engage in a policy like, unfortunately, Jill Stein is with the Green Party, where she's still asking people to vote for her in the 10 states that could potentially swing the election to Trump. I think I've learned the lesson that, no, the Sanders campaign has provided us with a model, a successful strategy for participating electorally. And we should understand, I think we had no reason to expect that we were going to win the Democratic nomination through the electoral process this year. The progressive forces in the United States aren't big enough and strong enough to do that. So what we wanted to do was to be able to talk about what does democratic socialism mean to millions, hundreds of millions of Americans. And Bernie Sanders has done that. He has talked about what democratic socialism means to hundreds of millions of U.S. citizens. He has made it a word that isn't a bad word that everybody is afraid to even talk about. And he has pointed out and said over and over again, we are in a situation where people are totally disfranchised. People have no control over what their government's doing anymore. We need a political revolution. So we have a candidate who has said we need a political revolution. We have a candidate who has spoken in concrete terms what democratic socialism can mean and how much better it is than neoliberal capitalism. And he has successfully campaigned and gotten that message out to hundreds of millions of Americans, came very close to winning the Democratic Party nomination. And there are now tens of millions of particularly young Americans who think, I'm for democratic socialism, and I'm for a political revolution. That's a tremendous step in the right direction that we have taken during this electoral campaign. It rebounds to the benefit of people building social movements. It basically gives us that missing piece to our overall strategy that we always struggle with. So in that sense, I am very impressed with something that's happened that was beyond any of it was certainly beyond my expectations. I'll go out on a limb. I don't think Bernie Sanders or his closest advisors had a clue that they would be this successful. They never expected to be this successful. So it's a huge and pleasant surprise that we need to recognize the importance of in terms of how we plan about going ahead in the future. We finally, I think, have a basic formula for how we can combine electoral campaigning at the national level with all the other activities that we've been doing for the past 20 years.
We really need to recognize that the road ahead is not an easy one, but that the sheer success of Bernie's campaign reflects exactly that as a society, you know, we have the moral compass to move towards a society that's more, that's built on reciprocity, that's built on interconnection with each other and with the environment, with the natural world. You know, in a society that really hungers for social justice and dignity that is, you know, to all, for all people, not just for a few and for those who can afford to buy it.
I was teaching on a campus this spring, and I was just amazed at how many of the students, this was at Lewis and Clark, which is a fairly affluent student population. I was amazed at just how powerful and overwhelming the sentiment for the Sanders campaign was on that campus. I mean, you look at the primary results, and I mean, he was getting, in the Democratic primaries, he was getting 85% of the vote under 30. From 18 to 30, 85% were voting for a guy who's older than me who's saying, I'm a democratic socialist and we need a political revolution. So in terms of who it is that has been turned on to the kind of ideas, values, politics that we have all believed in for decades and decades. I mean, Bernie did an incredible job of turning the American youth, putting them on a path where they're thinking in the right direction. They're very clear about what they want, and they're very clear about what they're disgusted with. And on those two issues, they're absolutely dead right. They're much more clear-headed than most older Americans are at this point. And the youth's always the future, so there is that to be hopeful for.
Thank you so much for being with us. I highly recommend that people buy your books and support your efforts as well, because you truly are a gift. Thank you very much for all that you do, and thank you for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Sylvia, and good luck to you Canadians.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.